Hello and welcome to Moms Fighting Autism. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernatitis, and we're pleased to be able to share this free webinar with participants from all around the world. You are a big part of this event, so I want to be sure you know how to participate. If you're on momsfightingautism.com, you'll see a blue box on your screen. Click Ask a Question to send questions for our presenter. The more questions we get, the better the presentation is for everyone. You'll also see slides. Click that button when the presentation begins to view the slides. You can synchronize the slides with either your phone or the webcast audio by clicking the button at the bottom of the slideshow. Be sure to mute your computer if you're using your phone to listen in so you don't get an echo. When we get to the Q&As, those participating with their telephone can ask a question by pressing star 2, and I'll remind you again later. But you press star 2 to alert me that you have a question. And don't be shy, because the question you ask is probably the same one someone else is afraid to ask. So tonight on Moms Fighting Autism, we'll be discussing Improving Reading Comprehension for Students on the Spectrum, A Parent's Guide to Simple, Effective Strategies You Can Use at Home. Tonight we have Dr. Carrie Miller with us. Dr. Miller is a board-certified educational therapist. She began her career almost 20 years ago as a special education resource teacher. She has worked with students in a vast array of capacities, including special education teacher and educational therapist. Dr. Miller has a PhD in educational psychology and mathematical statistics, a master's degree in learning disabilities, gifted education, and educational diagnosis, and a bachelor's degree in early childhood education and behavior disorders. Welcome, Dr. Miller.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm so pleased to be here, Nancy.
I'm so glad you're here with us.
Should I just get rolling?
You may. You may go right into it.
We are going to talk about kids pretty much in the middle of the reading comprehension spectrum. We're addressing kids tonight, and this came up as we were talking, Nancy and I, before the show, that there were vast, range of skill levels, and I've targeted my presentation there. And just to get us rolling, let me go ahead and advance my slides. Oh, there we go. Okay. Well, that's a little bit about me. As an educational therapist, I wanted to mention what that is, because many of you listening in other parts of the country other than California or maybe Chicago might not have heard that term before. Think of it as a reading specialist on steroids for kids who have complicated learning needs. And these learning needs could come from any one of a number or a combination of issues such as autism, attention deficit disorder, bipolar disorder, anxiety disorder, dyslexia. When kids have those kinds of issues, their learning is affected, sometimes to a great extent. And that's the specialty that I have as an educational psychologist, which is a specialist in the science of teaching and learning. I've devoted my years, almost 25 years now, I guess my bio's a little out of date, to helping learners with complicated profiles such as that. And through that time, I've created what I consider to be a highly effective system, and I've seen that with my students. It's a five-step system. I call it the Success Program, and it helps kids to be more successful in school. And I'm going to mention those steps as we go through the presentation. Here's to ground you for this presentation. You're in the right place if your child sounds out words better than he or she comprehends what she or he is reading. I'll just use one pronoun here. If he struggles with reading assignments, if he has difficulty determining anything that requires an interpretation, an inference, a prediction, and that would be things such as getting main ideas, determining causes and effects, finding out the motivations and emotions of a character, any of those kinds of things that require those higher level reading comprehension skills. And if your child has become discouraged with reading, feeling like he can't do it and he doesn't get anything out of it, it's just hard and he's feeling stupid. And it's for you, this presentation is for you, if you are frustrated because you've tried to teach your child yourself, but you don't feel you've got enough of the right kind of strategies. We're going to give you a lot of great strategies tonight. And if you feel disappointed because schools haven't had enough to offer you to help your child, definitely we'll be getting a lot of really great media information tonight. Well, why is it important to improve reading comprehension? Well, I think we all know this, but let's just make sure we all get that currently in our mind, because reading comprehension is a very, very important skill. If it's not addressed for kids who are in school, they become frustrated, they dislike school, they have poor grades, and then they begin to develop something that's called learned helplessness. Learned helplessness is this condition that happens to you when you try and try and try and try, and you fail and fail and fail and fail. Pretty soon you believe things such as, I'm stupid, this is too hard, I can never learn this. And so what do? You make different decisions. You forget to bring your book home. You don't turn in your work. You fall asleep over your assignments. All of these kinds of things may genuinely be that you're tired or something like, or you forgot it. But what happens is when you think you can't be successful, you just don't make those kinds of decisions that help you to become successful, because you've already written it off. It's not ever going to happen for you. And if you've got learned helplessness, if you dislike school, if you're frustrated, you may end up dropping out. And, of course, what's that going to do for your income in the future? It's really going to make a significant change in the amount of money that you can earn and the type of job that you can have. And I've worked with a lot of kids over the years, and I've helped a lot of them to get on a different path in life. And hopefully tonight's presentation will give you a little taste of how you can do that as well in reading comprehension. Now, when you have more reading comprehension, you enjoy reading a lot more. You're a lot more independent as a student. Naturally, your grades are going to go up because you're understanding what you're reading. You have a greater, much greater likelihood of graduating from high school and of going to and graduating from college. And, of course, you have more job opportunities that are going to open up for you, and they're going to have a higher income potential. Well, let's get into the Reading Comprehension Act itself. What do good readers do? Well, think about it. As you are reading, you are organizing the information in your mind, putting it into categories of various types, one of which is, I understand it, or I don't understand it. Another one is, oh, I like this, I don't like this. Another thing is, I agree, I don't agree. Another one is, oh, that's interesting, oh, that's boring. But in any case, you're making all kinds of judgments about what's going on if you're understanding, and you're fitting what you're reading into little boxes like that. You're also bringing in all of your own background knowledge to interpret what you're reading. That is, if you are a good reader, you're bringing in anything you know about the topic, anything that you've been interested in, that you've done any research, if your teacher mentioned it, all these kinds of things are firing off in your head when you're really understanding what you're reading. You're able to make inferences. You're able to put the pieces together for things that aren't explicitly stated. You'll be able to read between the lines. You'll be able to put the clues together. You'll be able to say, oh, I think this is what's going to happen next, because you're following that reasoning that the author is providing you. And you have a purpose. This is actually extremely important, and people don't often realize this, but you have a purpose for why you're reading. Now think about it. Why do you read the newspaper? Well, you may read the newspaper to relax. You may read the newspaper to gain information. But whatever it is that's your purpose, that's guiding the way you read. So if you're reading for information, then you're reading with more close attention to detail. On the other hand, if you're reading for entertainment, then you're guiding yourself without trying to get explicit details. You're getting more the feel of it. You're more in touch with how you feel while you're doing it. Your purpose for reading guides all the decisions that you make when you are reading. And it's really important that readers have the right purpose for the tasks that they're involved in order to get the most out of what they're reading. Okay, now, I'm sure you all are aware of this, but let's just make sure we're upfront. For kids on the spectrum, reading skills have to be taught. They have to be practiced many times over and over and over until they are well learned. And they have to be thought of in very small increments. Nancy and I were speaking before the broadcast began, and I want to use that as an example. She was talking about her child sounding out words and that was difficult. And I mentioned to her, we have to, when we're trying to see if a child knows how to, what a letter says, we have to separate the task of knowing what it says from being able to say it yourself. And this is exactly the same principle here. You have to make sure you look at each task in little bitty increments so that you can tell exactly where your child is having difficulty so you can provide your instruction right there. And then you've got to practice over and over until that is well learned before you go on to the next step. And you have to remember that skills are not just going to automatically transfer from one skill, from one subject, from one situation, from one person, from one book to another. You have to make sure that you build in what we call transfer through the way that you work with your child. And I'll tell you some more about that in the presentation tonight. And of course, I know you all know this is a long-term process. Reading, by the way, for people who are skilled readers and always have been skilled readers, is a long-term process that takes, I would say, up of 20 years to become a profoundly good reader. So don't expect your child to just do it overnight, because it is one of the most daunting tasks that we have to do as a human being. Now, what are we going to learn today? I'm going to give you an overview, what I call the sample platter. We're going to just get a little taste of each of the five principles of instruction that need to be incorporated into a remedial program in order for kids to be better comprehenders. And I want you to see that whole overview, because I think that 20,000-foot view is really important for you to be able to know what kinds of things might be missing from your child's program. But obviously, I can't go in depth on all of those principles. I mean, I've made a quarter of a century mastering that. But what I can do for you today, we can go in depth, what I call the main dish, on how to do one of those skills that comes from one of the principles, one of the five principles. And this is a really crucial skill. And if you learn the stuff that we have tonight, I can promise you that it'll give you tremendous value in helping your child. And this is how we prepare to read. Now think about it. If you were going to go out and run in a marathon, you'd have some preparation that you would do before you'd go out and do that. Well, in the same way, a good reader has prepared in order to begin that reading assignment or that reading for pleasure even. There's some preparation steps. And for kids on the spectrum, research is showing us that these certain steps that I'm going to share with you tonight are probably the most important that we need to teach. Now, we don't have a lot of research, but certainly what we do have up until now suggests that these steps are very critical. And then I'm also going to share with you some resources for you to get some more help if you need some more help. I would like to offer you all a copy of the slideshow. I don't know whether Moms Fighting Autism provides that for you, but you can certainly find it on my website. I've set up a special page just for you. If you go to my website at millereducationalexcellence.com/Moms Fighting Autism, you will find two things there. You will find the slideshow presentation as a PDF document that you can download and keep. And you'll also find a quote-unquote handout packet of the templates that I'm going to be talking about tonight. So if you want to go on over there, don't worry about putting in the capital letters in the website address. I just put that in to make it easier for you to see the address. And if you want to contact me, please feel free to do that. You can go to my website at millereducationalexcellence.com. And should I give them a couple minutes to go over there and get the slideshow, or should we just go on ahead?
You can go on ahead if you want to, and then just we'll reiterate it at the end.
Great. Okay. All right, so let's start with the five principles, and I call this my success program. These are the five things that you need to, they're big global concepts that we need to put in any remedial program to help kids move forward. Kids who have special learning needs, they don't learn easily in some respects. Sometimes learning is a great struggle. So we can't just teach the way we teach people who learn easily. It's just not going to work. More of the same old thing will never work. We have to do what's called differentiate our teaching. And that's certainly a term that's used in education today. And I mean that to mean take a learner's strengths and use those as the stepping stone for creating a program that makes good sense, that a learner can get their foothold on. Don't use methods that don't work. Use methods that do work. So when I work with kids, I find a method that works because everyone can learn, and it's my job to figure out how to teach. It's not the learner's job to meet me. It's my job to meet the learner. The next thing we need to do, we need to recognize that because learners have difficulty in one or more aspects of their learning, they all have skills that they haven't learned up until now. And they may be in the regular class and placed in, for example, third or fourth grade, but have some skills that are more on a first grader's level, for example. These kinds of things have to be identified and have to be addressed directly, because if they're left to fester, your child is just going to be hitting his or her head on a ceiling of knowledge. He can't move beyond. We want to make sure that that ceiling is eliminated, that they can learn as much as possible. For reading comprehension in particular, and for kids on the spectrum in particular, there are underlying language issues that impact reading, reading recognition, which is sounding out the words, and also reading comprehension. And there are different areas of language that affect those two areas of reading. And so we need to address those underlying issues and train them. For example, if your child has an auditory processing problem, learning to read is going to be very challenging because knowing the sounds and the symbols that stand for those sounds is based in being able to hear the sounds accurately. So there's no way a child can be taught to read every word by sight. That's too much. So that efficiency and economy of scale that comes from learning the sound-symbol relationships, the phonics, is essential to making great reading progress. So if auditory processing is a problem, it needs to be addressed in order for reading to progress as well. And kids need, particularly as they get into the upper elementary, middle school and high school level, they need to learn how to manage their own learning. And that's very possible. And the steps I'm going to show you tonight, I'll show you how you can build that into the program. In other words, what I'm going to show you tonight addresses all of these five principles, and it does so by teaching you how to get your child ready to read. So you got a lot. I hope it's not too much going on at the same time, but just remember, if you didn't have all of these principles being addressed, you wouldn't be getting great value out of what I have to show you. And you're going to be defeating learned helplessness at the same time, because as you get these techniques in place and your child starts to see forward momentum and starts to see that she can learn, she's going to feel like a more competent learner and going to start making better decisions about her schoolwork. Okay, so let's go a little bit deeper into what differentiating instruction is. As I mentioned, you want to use the child's strengths. You want to adapt for their learning style. You also want to incorporate their interests. So when I work with kids, if I know, for example, they're interested in dinosaurs, I do everything I can to build dinosaurs in some fashion into the instruction as often as possible, because it's just going to make it more resonant for a person if they're more interested. So they're more alert, they're more with you, they're having more fun, which is a good thing because fun signals different kinds of neurotransmitters present in the brain, and it's the good kind of neurotransmitters, the kind that facilitate learning. Most of our kids are more visual than they are auditory, but there again, everyone is unique. We can't make blanket statements, you know, beyond just usually it's true. Some kids have visual processing problems, and that certainly has to be taken into account as well. Sometimes kids have problems in both auditory and visual channels, and so we need to make our presentations multimedia. We need to use both hearing and sight and movement at the same time. You cannot go wrong with incorporating movement and concrete objects into your teaching. That's how the brain really learns. The brain learns. Think about it. Do we really learn by sitting still? No, we don't. We learn when we're able to write, to walk, to talk, to sing, to draw, any of these kinds of things. Movement is important for the brain in order to get the kind of feedback it needs to create new channels of learning. And so we really want to incorporate writing into teaching reading comprehension just to facilitate these steps that we have listed here. Oops, can't get my slide over. Okay, now here are some of the poorly developed skills that we really need to make sure we address in a thorough reading comprehension a remediation program. What we're going to talk about tonight, preparing to read, we need to make sure our students are visualizing what they're reading while they're reading. We need to make sure that they're taught how to find main ideas, causes and effects, and sequences and series, that they learn how to make inferences, predictions, and conclusions, and to determine the motivations of characters, that they're able to summarize in a short fashion, in their own words, paraphrase, what they have read. This is the step that's demonstrating what they know, and it's separate from actually knowing it, but that summarizing and that paraphrasing concept is really important to push your abilities on, so you want to help encouraging your child to be able to do that. It develops better reading comprehension skills when you can put things in your own words. And you need to be able to determine the structure of the passage. Are we reading about cause and effect? Are we reading about a description of a character? Are we reading about somebody trying to persuade me how to vote? You know, good readers determine what the author's purpose is, and then that's part of the structure of the passage. And then they see how the author has laid that all out. They see the author's argument, so to speak. Okay, and we need to address those underlying language issues. For our kids, that's often auditory processing problems. Sometimes it's acquiring a vocabulary. Sometimes vocabulary is limited for our kids. And many of our kids have difficulty with the non-literal language. Things like idioms, example is pull your weight, which doesn't mean, you know, to pull yourself along. It means to do your job, to do your fair share. There again, there's an idiom. Figurative language, you know, like busy as a bee. Homographs, which are two words that are pronounced differently and have different meanings but are written the same, such as wound and wound. And homophones, which typically are written different but sound the same, like eight and eight, or two, two, and two, which are the really, I should have used that as an example. It's an even better example. Two, two, and two are really challenging for kids. And then the double meanings. I kid you not, this is a real headline I found on the internet. Police begin campaign to run down jaywalkers. Now, if our kids were reading that, we wouldn't want them to think that the police were out there in their police cars trying to hit jaywalkers. Okay? We want to make sure they really understand the double meanings that are out there. And we want to help our kids teach, we want to teach them to manage their own learning. We can't start there naturally, but that's our goal. We want to teach them to monitor whether or not they're understanding what they're reading and then using specific strategies to stay on track to make sure that they are bringing themselves back if they don't understand, that they have a set of tools that they can use to get back on track. Okay, we're ready for the in-depth. We're ready for our main dish. I'm going to show you now how to teach your child to get ready to read. It's a great, great amount of information coming at you here. So don't feel overwhelmed. It's all laid out for you. You've got the slides. I'm going to answer your questions. Don't worry. It might seem like a lot at first, but I think it's going to be, when you get your teeth around this, you're going to go, oh, my gosh, there's so much amazing value there. So these are proven instructional techniques. As much as research has been able to demonstrate, because there's not a lot of research on our kids, but there is a lot of instructional research on the reader in general. So what we don't have for kids on the spectrum, we can borrow from reading research over many, many decades. And you're going to need to teach each step, as I said before, that your child has difficulty with. No step is too small to think about it as a piece that might need to be taught. Okay, here's the first thing you do. You're teaching your child a strategy, and this strategy is how you prepare, how you get ready to read something. So the very first thing you want to do is you want to name that strategy and explain why it's important. So you're going to say something like, we're going to learn how to get ready to read, we do this before we read because it helps us understand what we're reading. And if there's something in there that your child doesn't understand, it's not too small a step to go back and explain that. Make sure they really understand, well, why is it important to understand what you're reading? If they don't know that, make sure you explain that. There's no step too small. Then we're going to explain the strategy in as precise a fashion as possible, in as kid-friendly a language as possible, in a language that your child can understand. We're going to say that there are 6 steps in getting ready to read, and that you're going to show your child how to do each of the steps, and that you're going to write down the steps, you're going to keep them beside you, and you're going to use those every time you read. So there's one of your tools right there, one of your toolkits. You have a list of the steps you need, and you can always refer to it. Now, here are the steps, and I've included this for your information. And I'm going to go in depth on each of these 6 steps and show you how to do it. This is your overview so you can see where we're going. You need a clear title that tells you what to expect in the passage. Research has shown this is very key for our kids. You need to remember related experiences, ones that you've had, ones that you've heard about, any research you've done, places you've visited, that kind of thing. You need to learn the new words before beginning to read. Any word that's not known to you, we need to handle that. Here is a very, very key step. You need to figure out what each pronoun and demonstrative adjective stands for. Research has shown this is a key step for our kids. And I'm going to share with you what those are. Most people don't know what demonstrative adjectives are, so don't worry about that. I've got a whole list of them. I'm going to show you how to do that. We need to learn some more about the topic before we start to read. Now, this might be a small amount, but still, our related experiences might not be enough to get us there. And then we need to create some kind of visual record, whether it be an outline or using a graphic organizer that's pre-designed. Before we read and as we read, we're going to add to it. So let's delve into each of these steps. Now, the first step in getting ready to read is we're going to have an easy-to-understand title. So we read the title, and we talk about what it tells us, and if that title is not doing the job, if we're really not understanding what that means, if it's kind of idiomatic or just a funny title, and it really doesn't tell us what we're going to read about, we have got to write our own. So this is the first step that your child needs to learn, that the title is there like a badge, like a name tag. It's there to give you a really good idea of the general topic that you're going to be reading about. Now, the topic is a very broad thing. For example, Susie's birthday party. Okay, that's enough to just get us in the door. It doesn't really say anything important about Susie's birthday party. We don't have any details or anything yet, but we know it's a birthday party, and we might even know it's Susie, right? Okay, or it could just be the birthday party. But having fun one day might not really get your child into a zone where he could understand what this was going to be about, if it was about a birthday party. So we need a clear title, and so that means you need to be able to either have read it or skimmed through it yourself, and if the title doesn't do a good job of setting the stage, you need to help by writing one yourself. So first you're going to teach this by modeling it for your child, and then slowly but surely, step by step, you're going to teach your child to be able to do it on his own. And I've got that in there. Don't worry about it. I'm going to show you all the steps. Now, the next step you want to do after you've got a good title, you want to remember any related experiences. So you need to start talking about anything that you know about the topic, and you're going to make a list of all these things. Now, research has shown that sometimes our kids will make irrelevant or unusual associations to a title. And that's why we really want to help them at this stage, because it is essential for them to pull out what they know about a topic that's related to what they're going to read. But we have to help filter for them and help them see how that's probably not related to what we're going to read about. And your child will get better at that with more and more you showing him how to do that and making this more and more of a priority. That skill is going to improve. And here's the thing I really want to share with you. Any skill can be improved, and often dramatically. It just takes being focused and dedicated and seeing all the little steps that have to be instructed in order to get that major skill to move ahead. But I want to give everybody hope, because I've been doing this for so long. I've seen so many people just light year from beginning to end, and it's because if you just dedicate yourself to seeing each and every little step and teaching at each and every level and making sure your child can do it before you move on, you will go far. You really will. Okay, so they really do need our help here in filtering through the related experiences to make sure that we get the ones that are appropriate for what we're going to read about. Now, this is a very key step. We need to make sure that we identify and learn all the new words before beginning to read. Now, it's not like we're going to spend a lot of time memorizing them. What we're going to do is we're going to find all the words that, or figurative language as well, vocabulary and figurative language and idioms that your child does not understand, and you're going to highlight them. Then you're going to make a list of those words to keep forever, and you're going to put what they mean right next to it. So if you're finding that in the first two or three sentences you have seven words, this is way too hard a passage for your child, and you need to find some way to make adjustments. And if any of you have that kind of issue, please be sure to ask me a question about that, because at the end, do whatever I can to help you interface with the school, getting the work the right level. Remember, you got to start where your child is and move forward. That's how we can't skip any of the steps. We can't light year past things. Every developmental step has to be done, and it has to be there and as a firm foundation to move on. So if there's room in the passage, write what the word means right in there so that you don't have to look to the other list. Now, as I say, if there's too many of these, this passage is too hard. Your child should not be reading it. Now, many of you are going, what the heck is a demonstrative adjective? Okay, here's your time to get that question answered. Now, pronouns are things, he, she, it, you. So if you're reading it along and it says, Sally gave it to her, well, we're not sure, first of all, what it is, and we're not sure who her is. And that's going to throw your child off. In fact, research has shown that for kids on the spectrum, that really throws them off. And so what we really need to do is we need to identify all of the he, she, it, you, they, we, and we have to figure out who that refers to and write it right there in the passage. Now, demonstrative adjectives are things like this, these, that, those, and I also included former and latter because in the high school passages you see those words a lot. So, I gave this to her. We need to go back and figure out what the this is, because your child is just going to see that as this. It's not going to resonate. It may or it may not. I can't say for sure. But for a lot of our kids, that's just not going to resonate. So you have to go back and you have to identify what each of these is. Now, I think you can see just from that step how much help it will be for reading comprehension if you just do those right there. So let's go what the next step is. We want to learn a little bit more about the topic before we read, because remember, some of our associations are irrelevant, and we might not have thought of some of the things that might be very relevant, particularly if we're in middle school or high school. We need to find out a little bit more about that topic, and someplace you really should be looking. For example, if you're in a social studies or science textbook, you should really be looking at the questions in the book. You should be looking at the, I didn't put this in here, but because that's part of the graphic organizer step, but another place you can look for your information is in the titles of the subheadings, you know, the titles of the sections, the introduction or preface that's right there. If it's a narrative work, a story on the book jacket, you can even go to sites such as SparkNotes or BookRags or any place on the internet that gives you a little background about a story that will help you understand more about what you're going to be reading about. It's a crucial step to have your roadmap in front of you before you start out on your journey. And this is one of the important steps. You really need to know a little bit about that topic before you get reading. And now here comes the graphic piece. You need to either choose an outline, and if you've gone to my website, you'll see that handout packet is a set of graphic organizers, and we're going to talk a little bit about those. You either want to pick or develop a graphic organizer, or you want to start an outline. And it depends, of course, on your child's preferences, your child's learning style, your child's age, your child's skill level, what, you know, grade placement, all of those kinds of things, as to what's the most appropriate graphic way to get what they're reading documented or outlined or mapped out. Or there has to be some way of connecting what you're reading to a motor activity. It's a really key step. Plus also now it becomes the written record, so that if you're going to be tested on it, for example, you can use that as a study aid. Or if you're, you probably use this tip already, but I'll give it to you if you don't know it. If your child's in a school where they're assigning reading assignments, you want to get the reading assignment in advance, and you want to do the reading in advance in the subjects that your child has difficulty with, and go through this process and create a written record. So then when your child goes to school, has this written record, and he can look down at this graphic organizer or outline to answer any questions that might come up in class. It'll make him it'll increase his class participation and make him feel much more like he's participating. It really changes how he views himself in relationship to the rest of the class to be able to participate on a high level. Now, some of the graphic organizers that you can use, what you want to do is make your own or select some, and then make a lot of templates and make a lot of copies, and use those over and over. You want to keep, this is one of your ingredients, so to speak, in this cake, this main dish, that you want to make sure you have plenty of, that you always can reach over there and grab one when you need it. Now, the kinds of things that kids, that we write about, and therefore kids are taught about, are to compare and contrast things on some particular quality. And I've got a graphic organizer in the packet that shows you that, and I'll talk a little bit about that. We need to put things in order, in sequence, for example, for a process or a procedure, or just because this happened first, this happened second. Then we need to identify a big important idea, a main idea, and all the things that support it, all the things that are details about it. We need to be able to determine what causes something and its effect, what it caused. And we need to be able to evaluate or analyze something, you know, whether this is good or bad, whether it should be, where we should vote for this or not, whether this is, you know, that kind of thing. We need to be able to bring our own personal evaluation into it. Okay. All right. So now, where are we? We're guiding the student in using this strategy. So we've named the strategy. We've described why it's important. We've, let me look at my list, make sure I remember all of these steps. Oh, we precisely explained it. And we give an example. I didn't put that in your list, but you want to make sure that your child really understands what you're doing. So you give them an example if they don't understand. And now what we want to do is we want to demonstrate this to your child. Don't expect them to just do it. You want to show them how to do it. In education, we call this scaffolding. And what it means is providing the kind of support necessary for a learner to bring a new skill into their repertoire. So you want to show them as many times as necessary, giving them just actually doing it, asking them a lot of questions, giving them the starter, giving them like a multiple choice, which one do you think it is, anything that you need to do to just make sure that they're really getting the point. But you have to remember, this may take a long time to teach. Okay, so you want to make sure you address each and every step along the way and give a lot of support. Now, as soon as your child is able to become more independent, and that may be fast, it may be a lot longer, it depends on the task and for your child, because everybody's got their own profile of strengths and weaknesses. So you may be on one topic for a long time, but on two or three other topics, you can get through them very quickly. It all depends. But after you've had enough practice showing your child, you've shown your child enough, now it's time for your child to do it on his or her own. So you want to make sure that you set up the conditions so that they've had enough examples so that they are able to start trying it on their own. They might not be able to completely solo on their own. You might need to check in now and then. You might need to help with some little bit of the process, but they should be able to, at this stage, do a lot of it on their own. And that's the stage you want them to practice on their own as long as it's necessary before you go to the next phase. And the next phase is the transfer phase. That's where you help your child learn to use the skills of getting ready to read in every situation that's appropriate. Sometimes kids need a little bit of help with that. Sometimes they need a lot of help with that. So if you've been teaching your child how to read a language arts passage, and you know, like a book or story, and now you have to shift to science, well, that is going to be a little bit different because science is a very different topic. Science has different organizations. Remember the structure of the passage. Science is organized to present facts and supporting details, but that's not how stories are organized. So all of this getting ready to read steps needs to be taught in each area until your child is really showing that he or she can be independent in those areas. And again, don't assume they can make that leap without instruction because sometimes they can, sometimes they can't. Now here again, just to summarize, here are the steps that we're going to use in teaching any strategy, not just getting ready to read, but any strategy. So this is something, if you're working with your child extensively, I would encourage you to print this out and keep it right with you as you're working, because this is the basic setup that you're going to go through for everything. You're going to name the strategy and explain why it's important to learn it. You're going to precisely explain it in simple terms. You're going to give a simple example so that the student already understands, that the student already understands, so that it makes the leap between what you're saying and what your child already knows. There again, that's not something you should take for granted. Demonstrate that strategy sufficiently. Do it as many times as necessary till your child can select from a couple alternatives what's the right answer. Then you know that you've demonstrated to the point where they understand. Now, guide your child in using that strategy. Give them as much help as long as they need. Then back off your support. Let them be more independent with occasional checking in, maybe a little reteaching on a step if it's weak, and then transfer is the last step, encouraging the use of that strategy in other situations. Oh, okay, so now what I want to do for the last few minutes, I want to show you in the context of Joseph, not his real name, by the way, but he is a real student of mine. I want to show you how I use those five principles of learning. Oh, and that would be on slide 11. Let me just refresh your memory there. Slide 11, those five principles of learning. We want to differentiate our teaching based on learning style and strengths. We want to teach poorly developed skills. We want to find each one of them and teach them until they are better, until they're good is what we would hope for. We want to address the underlying language issues or any other issue that a child is having, but particularly in reading comprehension, we're looking at language issues. We want to teach them to self-manage their learning, to have a set of tools, and to use those tools and to stay on track and to know when they're off track and to go get those tools and to use them. And we want to make sure we defeat learned helplessness, that feeling that I'm stupid, I can't learn this, this will never work for me. Okay, so let's go back. I think I was about here. Oh, I've got to use that, don't I? I'm sorry. I see what I did. Oh, I could have just gone to the next slide. I apologize. Okay. All right, so here's Joseph's story. He's chuckling at me. Okay. Well, as happens with many of our kids, Joseph had pretty good word recognition skills, but his comprehension was an issue for him. He really didn't understand what he was reading. And, of course, in first and second grade, that is not a really red flag. And it doesn't show too much because in the first couple of grades, we're wanting our kids to sound out the words, and our attention is more on that. So when a child is doing okay with that, we don't really think too much, you know, that they're not getting meaning out of it. It is something that you should be looking at. Depending on the age of your child, I know people probably have some very young kids here on the call, and some of you have high school kids, and so you should always be thinking, reading is an act of gaining meaning. It's nothing more than that. It is the sole reason we read. It is to gain meaning. So if your child is showing that he can sound out words but doesn't know what they mean, your child is not actually reading. The definition of reading is getting meaning from printed words. So keep that in mind. You want to make sure you're looking at that. Mom spent hours every night helping with homework, reteaching a lot of concepts. Finally, in fifth grade, the district, he was in a public school, evaluated him and found what Mom had seen all along, a large discrepancy between the ability to recognize and sound out words and the ability to understand what they meant. And so the school's response naturally was, I say naturally because school doesn't have an awful lot of options, at least that matter much to our kids. He went into a resource class, which was basically a homework club. And with here, you know, his mom, he's one-to-one with an adult and him. But in a resource class, it's one to whatever the caseload is, 1 to 8, 1 to 10, 1 to 25, whatever it is. So he's not getting a lot of help during that time. Family, of course, thought, okay, this is not working so well. Let's try some tutoring. That, of course, didn't go very well either. And so finally, the family became aware of educational therapy and found me. So I did use the 5 principles of instruction. I changed the way I taught to match how he would actually learn. I found those skills that were standing in his way that weren't well developed, and I taught him how to do those. I looked at the underlying language issues to see, because reading is a language task, to see which of those wasn't in place at the level it needed to be, and I worked on those. I gave him a set of tools to use, taught him how to use those tools and how to tell when he was off track and needed to use one of those tools. And because we did all of those things, he began to feel like a better student, a more smart person, and that's how we defeated the learned helplessness. So let's talk a little bit about how I put all those together in reading comprehension here. So Joseph's profile, like many kids I work with, and perhaps your child as well, is not a simple, straightforward we can't even say one diagnosis, no matter what that diagnosis is simple and straightforward. But sometimes our kids have multiple diagnoses, which bring with them multiple issues. So as I alluded to before, he had auditory processing problems, but he also had visual processing problems. And so both had to be taken into account. Pardon me, I'm sorry. Both had to be taken into account. And so we needed a multi-sensory approach for Joseph. He also had ADHD, which certainly complicates the picture. ADHD in and of itself is very challenging. It can produce a great deal of difficulty for kids when they're trying to learn. So we put autism with ADHD with visual processing and auditory processing, and we have a complicated picture. But it's not one that can't be worked with. It absolutely can be worked with. Because we have all of these things going on at the same time, of course it makes sense. We're going to need more instruction over a longer period of time. Now, poorly developed skills that are relevant in this particular area, and there were other areas as well. Joseph had a math disability, which I didn't mention because this is not a talk about math. But so I was working with Joseph on a lot of different things. And so within the reading area, though, I needed to make sure that I gave him the kinds of tools that he needed so that he'd be a good reader. So teaching him how to prepare to get ready to read, all of those things that I mentioned, having a clear title, remembering your related experiences, and then sifting through them to see if they're relevant, learning the new words, figuring out what the pronouns and the demonstrative adjectives stand for, learning some more about the topic, and then creating some kind of written record, an outline or a graphic organizer. You see how you need to instruct on multiple steps there, but he needed to have that in place. Just doing that was a tremendous boost to his reading comprehension. And that's what I can tell you tonight, everyone listening on the call. Doing the things that I suggested there for the preparing to read step, you teach those things, it will make a big impact. It really should. For everyone listening here on the call, because you can probably tell from all of that there's a lot there that will just help you know what's actually happening, you know, get all that confusion out of the way. And then with the narrative templates and the expository templates, that's your handout packet, showed him how to use all of those, how to make his own. And then at this stage, he's now ready to begin to do more inference tasks. And that's really what determining a main idea is. It's an inference skill. It's the ability to put all the pieces together and see, out of that topic, let's say Susie's birthday party, what's the important thing that the author is saying about that topic? Maybe the important thing is, Susie had an awful time at her birthday party. That's the main idea. So the topic is Susie's birthday party. The important idea about it is the main idea. And then the details that might fall from that are someone threw up on her and nobody brought her gifts or I don't know. But those would be the details. And you put those all together to determine that she had a bad time. Now you see that's an inference skill. It's putting all of those pieces together. That's something our kids have difficulty with. It's not the first thing we teach them to do. And then he needed to learn how to summarize and paraphrase, how to succinctly, briefly say what the passage had been or paragraph had been about in his own words. Very key. And taught him a visual note-taking system, whether it's either outlines or graphic organizers. It has dual benefit. You use it to document your reading, but you can also use it, as I mentioned before, to study for tests. And he didn't have a great deal of difficulty in visualizing while he was reading, but he needed to learn to remind himself to do it and to do the right kind of visualization at the right time. Sometimes kids will go for a long period of time without visualizing anything, and then they suddenly realize they have no idea what they've been reading. We need to visualize frequently as we read. I address the underlying language issues. So obviously we had to get with the idioms and the figures of speech and homophones and homographs and those double meanings. That was an issue for him. So we had to teach as many of those that you're going to find constantly anyway, you know, like busy as a bee or pull your weight. And then anything that came up in a social studies or science context, we'd make lists of those because he'd probably be visiting them again in subsequent textbooks. And then we had to directly address auditory processing difficulties through structured drills that helped his ear and brain. Really, auditory processing is a brain skill, not an ear skill, so I don't mean to mislead you there, but helped his brain better interpret the sounds that were coming in. In Joseph's case, vocabulary was a relative strength. He didn't need any help there. I taught him to self-manage his learning, and for a person who has ADHD, that's a key component of any instructional program. So it complicated the picture. I needed to teach him more strategies on keeping himself focused, on filtering out distracting side thoughts, on knowing whether or not he was on track. And then the basic techniques that I've been talking about here about monitoring reading, recognizing when he didn't understand something, and then being able to get that toolkit out and use it, helping him learn how to schedule his time so he had enough time to read and create the graphic organizers and study. There's a lot that needed to be addressed because of the ADHD that complicated things. And, of course, this really made a big difference in how he saw himself. He was avoiding reading because he couldn't get main ideas, he couldn't make inferences, everything was so challenging. Finally, after our work, he felt that he was a much stronger student. He took on a lot more challenges. He'd start his reading earlier, he'd do more of the graphic organizers, he'd study harder, he'd study sooner, more in advance of the test, get stronger grades. Everything shifted for him. Ah, okay, well, that's basically presentation. So here again, I want to let you know where you can get the slideshow and the handout packet of the templates. And I just want to briefly mention what the templates are so you know what you've got there. Go to my website at millereducationalexcellence.com/momsfightingautism. And the handout packet, some of these, I don't know where I've gotten them because I've had them for so very long. But at the very end, you'll see that there is a citation. And so let's just go through this real quick because I'm also going to show you where you can get some more resources. And so let's talk about that first, and then I'll come back to the templates. A book that I really want to draw your attention to is written by a colleague of mine here in Los Angeles. Her name is Emily Island. That, the typeface doesn't make that very clear. That's an I-L-A-N-D, Island. And her book is called Drawing a Blank, Improving Comprehension for Readers on the Autism Spectrum. And here I've provided you with a web link where you can buy it from her. I believe that's her, maybe it's from the publisher. I think it's from the publisher. Anyway, I highly encourage you to grab this book if you are interested in working more with your child on reading comprehension. She does an exceptional job reviewing the literature, laying out instructional strategies, and I actually drew some of my material from that. I'll give her great credit for that. She is a wonderful resource there. And there are two books, one of which is Learning on Purpose, a Self-Management Approach to Study Skills, which I've included two of their graphic organizers in your handout packet. And those are the ones that are cited from critical thinking books. And then another book that I use a lot that helps kids with study strategies is School Power. And I really like those, all three of those. I can highly recommend those. So the templates that you have address the major issues. The first one's called the W organizer. That's just like the who, what, when, where, why. Now, keep in mind that this is just the way this one is drawn. You don't have to draw them like that. You can draw them like the next page, page 2, called a descriptive map, where the person, place, or thing, that could be your subject. And then each of those things that is like the spider legs spinning out, that's called a descriptor, that could be, one of those could be the who, and another one could be the what. You don't have to draw these exactly the same. Just find a way that your child understands it. That's what you want to go for. Then on the descriptive map page, there's also a different hierarchy. It's kind of like the W organizers. And this one's more hierarchical. And I would use this one more where the person, place, or thing is. I would use main idea there. And then attribute could be detail. And then you could have even more detail under there. And I also like the way that you can use that to describe a person, a place, or a thing. So you could describe, you could even describe Susie's birthday party. And one of the attributes was everybody left early. And then maybe one of the descriptors was somebody threw up, something else, okay? So you can find creative ways to use these in multiple contexts. The third page in the handout packet is for the sequence. Anything in a process or a procedure, first, second, third, can go in either a straight across, horizontal fashion, or up and down, or in this case down, vertical fashion, or even around in a circle if it's the kind of the thing that repeats itself, if it iterates. And there's also a kind of a main idea graphic down there. You might find that one useful. I never used that one, but it was on the page. So everybody's different. Everybody has their own way of looking at things and making sense of what they see. The next page is a cause and effect map, and there's different ways you could do that. You could have the cause and an arrow. I like the arrow because the arrow signifies to a lot of people that something is being caused. But also you notice the arrows in the sequential map, so that indicates a progression of time. So either way, if your child is confused by multiple uses of the arrow, then pick one and go with that. And here you have different ways, you know, one cause, one effect, one cause, three effect, three causes, one effect. So it'll give you some ideas there. And then the ones from critical thinking. I'm going to read this because when I printed it out, it didn't print out very well. I want you to know what's in the middle column. I mentioned that earlier in the presentation. When we compare and contrast two things, it's always in regard to some kind of quality. So what's in the middle black area there, it says how different with regard to, and then there's an arrow, there's a number of arrows. You're supposed to write a quality on that arrow. So let's see. We got Susie's birthday party. Let's say Josh's birthday party. Okay. So how are they alike? Both birthday parties, whatever. Now, how are they different with regard to? So the first quality they might be different on is child's age. So under the left-hand side for Susie, Susie is 8 years old. And over on the right-hand side for Josh, Josh is 27 years old. So they're different in regard to the birthday ease age. Okay. Now that you might say to yourself, oh, okay, so I bet there was a different type of party. So maybe they were different in regard to type of party or place where the party was held. All of these are particular qualities, and they should go in the center column. That really, really, really helps. Instead of just saying, oh, he's 18 or he's 27, she's 8, being able to be guided to and then eventually to state yourself, what is that different quality? Just ups the thinking skills dramatically and encourages reading comprehension. And the last one in the packet is an assumptions, reasons, and conclusions. And I like that for multiple reasons. In that conclusion, you could also put main idea. And then your details can go in the reason. Or you can use it as it is. And so, again, I just want to come back by saying, don't feel daunted, okay? Incorporate those five elements of instruction. Let's see if I can get that back onto the slide for you. That is slide 11. And I have to go back this way, don't I? Okay, make sure I get to 11. Okay. So incorporate the five principles of learning. Differentiate based on strengths and interests. Find all the skills that, and think micro. Think all the skills, find all the skills that your child has difficulty with, and teach each one. Look for the underlying language skills that are standing in the way of reading comprehension. Give your child tools so that eventually he can start managing his learning himself, and they'll all come together to defeat that feeling of helplessness and stupidity that your children can have. And thank you very much. I hope you got a lot out of that.
And the packet that you keep referencing, they can access that by going to your website /momsfightingautism.
Absolutely.
Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. Now, before we get into Q&A, I'm going to go ahead and do my little spiel that I usually do at the end. And I wanted to make sure that those of you who are participating through your computers, that you know that you can go ahead and put all your questions in where it says ask a question, and we'll get to as many of those questions as we can in the time allotted. And the ones we don't get to, I will send to Dr. Miller, and she can address those individually as she chooses. And if you're listening with your telephone, you can press star 2 at any time now and let me know that you have a question you'd like to ask. It's always nice to have live questions and chit-chat back and forth with our participants, and that's really fun. So if you're listening on your phone and you have a question you'd like to ask, go ahead and press star 2. I want to let you know before we get to the questions and answers that if you want a transcript of this event, you can join our Spectrum Gold Club for just $1 for the first month, and you will receive a copy of this webinar audio and transcript. And as a Spectrum Gold Club member, you'll also have access to the 51 previously recorded autism webinars that we've done thus far. That's 102 hours of recordings and transcripts. And you'll have access to the new monthly webinars as they become available. So that's an amazing amount of information you have access to for just $1. Each month we find notable experts on autism, and we bring them directly to you in a live two-hour webinar. We cover every topic imaginable, from the medical aspects of seizures and gastrointestinal issues to behavior, sensory issues, siblings, diets, financial planning, and much more. It's like traveling to all the autism conferences in a year without ever leaving your home. And you can listen to them over and over again as often as you'd like. Just click Join Spectrum Gold Club on your home screen there at Moms Fighting Autism for more information and how to join. Also, be sure and tell us what you think. Call us at 877-211-0212, extension 1, and leave us a short comment or testimonial. Again, that number is 877-211-0212, extension 1. And we will be addressing our questions here momentarily. Go ahead and mark your calendars now for our next webinar, which will be October 17th. We will be talking with Valerie Herskowitz, and she will be discussing with us speech and language issues. So you certainly don't want to miss that one. It's going to be again on October 17th, same time, same place. It's always 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, which is where I am in Ohio. But we kind of do that so we can accommodate the West Coast and the East Coast and hopefully some folks around the world as well. We have a number of questions coming in through the website. also remember that you can go to her website to get that packet of information she was referencing. So you want to go to millereducationalexcellence.com/momsfightingautism, and that's how you will get that packet she was talking about with all the examples and all the diagrams and everything that you can use. Let's see who's on our phone right now, if anybody has a question they'd like to ask. Don't be shy. Remember, the questions you ask might be someone else's question that they're afraid to ask. Are we ready for some questions, Dr. Miller?
Absolutely.
Okay. We had one come in from Virginia. The question is, what kind of strategies do you use for focusing for ADHD?
Oh, okay, wow. That is a huge, let me give you what I can in a few minutes because is there any more context provided there, like age of child or what focusing?
I read it word for word.
Okay, all right. Well, ADHD, I'm going to start with a little background. ADHD is a condition that is really at its core a deficit or a difficulty in filtering and prioritizing the environment. So let's start with that. A person with ADHD has difficulty knowing which of the thousands of stimuli the brain is receiving at any moment in time, and it really is that many, is the important one or ones to be paying attention to. Based on, here comes the priority piece and the filtering piece, based on your goals for the moment. So, for example, focusing. If you are reading a reading assignment and your purpose is to get as much out of it as possible so you can do well on the test, you are filtering out as many of those other distracting stimuli that may be floating through your brain or coming to you through your eyes or that you're feeling in your feet or because it hurts or whatever, and you are being guided by your purpose. But if your purpose is, I would really like to get outside and play, it's pretty hard to do any filtering of the distracting thoughts. And that's the first place you have to start, and I really emphasize that, because the person who has ADHD has to buy in to what they're doing at any point in time, because all the external strategies in the world, and I'm going to give you some of those too, will not compensate for the innate desire to do something. Okay, so you have to look at that picture for your child. Depending on your child's age, if your child is older, your child is much more able in high school to be setting out their own purposes for getting ahead in life. But when they're little, they don't have those kind of missions. Okay, so little kids cannot set out, my purpose is to get a good grade, because little kids cannot see past the end of their nose, you know. They don't have that kind of focus. The parts of the brain that allow us to do that don't come online, and they begin to come online, you know, 15, 12, somewhere in that range, depending on people, and they don't stop developing until the age of 30. That's why high school kids still are so reckless, because they don't have that break part of the frontal lobes is not well developed yet. Now, for kids who are younger, focusing strategies have to really take into account their age. So for elementary kids, you need to be using their learning strengths as much as possible. Little kids need to move. Little kids need to have short bursts. They're like a cheetah. They need short bursts of learning with a little break. Short bursts of learning with a little break. You have to build in rewards because they are not internally motivated by anything except their own desires. They cannot see future good yet. So you have to use more external reward systems for them. You have to get distractions out of the way. For older kids, because I'm not sure how old your child is, but here's a couple of good tips for older kids. I like to teach them to listen to their side thoughts. That's something we all as adults should do anyway. When we get, let's say we're reading, and we get all of a sudden we can become aware that we're not processing what we're reading anymore, and we're thinking about, oh, what I should buy at the grocery store or something like that. It's a good time for us to notice that and then to say, is my side thought relevant to the issue at hand? Well, if we were reading about good cooking, maybe it is relevant. But if we were reading about cellular respiration, which is the process of cells transferring oxygen, bringing in oxygen and releasing carbon dioxide, then I don't think going to the store is a relevant time right now. So you want to identify your side thought as being relevant or irrelevant to your purpose at hand. And here again, for an older person, it has to come back to that purpose. So now that I've talked my way through that, I think the best idea I would give to you is to make sure for your older child that you really are working on that purpose for doing anything, because that's where all of their decisions are coming from. And for your little kids, you're structuring the environment to provide more of what little kids need, which is frequent breaks, cheetah mentality, short bursts of focus interspersed with some relaxation. I don't mean relaxation like go and goof off. I mean like you have to stop thinking about that thing for a little while. And then you have to have movement, and you have to provide as much concrete manipulatives and one-to-one guidance as you can. And I hope that addressed the kind of issue that they were getting at, because it could have been from the classroom perspective they were thinking about. But
mm-hmm. Okay. Tiffany from Tulsa asks, is there a listing of accredited educational therapists? She has looked into places like Sylvan and has had lots of complaints and disappointed clients.
Yes, if you go to AET, that stands for Association of Educational Therapists. So it's A like Apple, E like Edward, T like Tom, AETonline.org. You can put in your city. And if you have any other specifications like age of child or particular subject like math or literacy that you're looking for, Tulsa, I can't say off the top of my head, but I doubt that there's anybody in Tulsa, but I hope so.
Yeah, me too. She also said in another question that she has contacted a facility and the testing was around $400. And around $25 to $30 a session. Is that about typical?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. Now, that's Tulsa. I can tell you what the rates in Los Angeles are, which are probably a lot higher. So, and also testing can range everywhere from a person who basically has a little bit more than a high school education to someone who has a PhD in neuropsychology, and naturally, the depth of information is going to be vastly different. The number of tests are going to be vastly different. So I think that's the best guideline there. $20 an hour for services in Los Angeles is the level of education of somebody who's maybe in high school. Now, I can't calibrate, you know, our rates here are much higher than that, so I can't calibrate for Tulsa. But at least that'll give you some guidance.
Right. Lorena from Texas asks, my son can visualize the story while reading, So it's easy to answer classic W questions, the what, where, who, why, and how. But predictions and inferences are very difficult, such as what's going to pass next, assumptions about character motives. She said, I need ideas on how to teach that to my child. Any ideas or thoughts?
Okay, now I'm assuming this is elementary. I'm also wondering, because those are the hardest pieces. The visualization. I'm just trying to think whether some of the things that we shared tonight absolutely need to be in place for this to develop. I mean, it helps. I'm not sure how much she has done of the idioms and other things. Let's assume that that's not the issue. So we'll go past that. Okay. So, those are the hardest things. I would assume then that your child is also having difficulty in social situations, understanding motivations of people. And so you can see how they would relate together. And I would also suggest that using a platform to train both makes the most sense. So if she's involving her child in social skills training by a social skills group facilitator who's specifically trained to work with kids on the spectrum, that will be a great way to segue or lead into how you can do these same kind of skills in a reading comprehension vein. Because if it's not there in a social context, it would be impossible to have it generate a step away from that, or maybe even three steps away from that, which is what a reading task is. We're reading about life, not participating in it. It's much more abstract to us. So you really do need to make sure that it's there in a social context first. If she wants to write in and say whether or not she's done social skills and she's still having issues. But you definitely have to start with being sure that your child can determine some motivations in a real-life situation before you can even read about them.
Mm-hmm. This may be completely off topic, but when you were talking about understanding the difference between 2-2 and 2,
oh, yeah.
It made me think, it made me wonder, how has texting affected reading comprehension? Because people, when they're texting, or kids, when they're texting each other, will just put the number 2.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Shorthand.
You know, I'm not aware of the research on that specifically, and I'm sure there's none on our population of kids in the spectrum. But I think in general, for kids, for example, with learning disabilities, I think that hampers their ability to tell the difference. And I can only assume and extrapolate that to kids on the spectrum. I think that does make it challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as long as they're being taught explicitly and they're able to differentiate, you know, we all put knowledge in little buckets. Like, here's how I spell when I text. Here's how I spell when I turn in my paper. As long as they're able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mary from Frankfurt wants to know, do you know any good reading curriculums that target comprehension and are effective with kids with autism?
Ooh. Now, not per se, but, you know, like a program you could buy, like the XYZ system. But I would highly encourage you to get Emily Island's book,
mm-hmm.
because she'll go through the strategies.
Okay, so not any one particular curriculum, such as, you know, phonics
no.
in a box or
no.
anything like
not
that.
Not for comprehension, no. That's hard to teach in and of itself to any kind of learner.
Mm-hmm.
And then you put the specific issues that kids on the spectrum tend to face on top of that, and I'm not familiar with the curriculum, no.
Yeah. I've tried a number of curriculums just to try and teach my son to read, and I've fallen short
yeah.
with all of them. From, you know, just teaching sight words to phonics to, you know, everything I could think of.
I know, and I wish I could be more help on that, but the reality is the more complicated the learning need, the more you need the specialized training of somebody who has studied a lot of stuff, and you don't have that prepared in a curriculum for a really complicated learner.
Although this presentation that you just gave was targeted toward a more advanced reader, do you work with children that are just emerging?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
It was just my assumption, you know, my guess to kind of hit
the
middle of the road here.
Yeah, you really can't, you know, make it broad enough to cover everybody's issues.
Oh, yeah. Yes, not with reading, that's for sure, because it's a 20-year endeavor.
But, you know, it is possible for those of us who are just emerging that we could find a therapist that could help us possibly.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
All right. All is not lost.
No, not at all, not at all.
Okay. Good. That's good to know. I'm going to pluck out another question here. Wendy from Connecticut asks, my son with high-functioning autism is 7 and in the second grade. He is above grade level in reading, but he tends to read too fast, and then he loses the meaning or details of what he's reading, especially when he is doing homework. What ideas do you have to get the child to slow down and absorb the content of what they read without getting them frustrated?
Okay. Yeah, I see that all the time with kids with autism, also with kids with learning disabilities, because they view reading as a word-calling activity. They don't view reading as a meaning-gaining activity.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, just like with everything, first of all, come back to the purpose. Explain again, the purpose is to get meaning. If we're not getting meaning, we're not really doing the job we need to do. And here she would use the words that are appropriate for your child, you know. So you have words, you know, like you're not doing the kind of job you need to be doing or whatever it is that you use to signal, I believe in you, I know you can do this. If you make a slightly different decision, everything will be fine. That's the kind of language that you want to bring in there. You don't want to ever let a child think that they're doing something wrong. You just want to let them know, here's some instruction. Here I have something to offer you that will make it more effective for you. That's the kind of language you want. So you've got to start with that purpose. And then I think the things that we shared about preparing to read, we need to, just because you can sound out a word doesn't mean you know what it means. So you do need to take that time, prepare to read. Look them over, see if there's any words that you know or, don't know. Make sure that that title is really clear. All of the things that I mentioned here, having you do all of those things is going to take some time. And so that in and of itself is going to provide a lot more basis for comprehension for your child. If you use all of these strategies that we had here, I think you'll find great success with it. But if you're still finding that he's reading too quickly, then I would you can start this by pre-marking what he needs to read. Let's say it's seventh grade, so okay, 7 years old, so it's probably not more than a few paragraphs. So at the end of every paragraph, put something like a little sticker or something like that. And that signifies now we stop and we tell what's in the little movie in our head to our partner before we go on. This is kind of like a partner share.
Okay. Is it important that school and home be using the same techniques?
The more challenge that a student has in that concept of transfer, yes, the more important that is. So for kids who have a great deal of difficulty using more than one approach and getting any benefit from it, then people being on a team and in alignment as much as possible is crucial. But there are some kids who can do fine with two different approaches, particularly if the one, like if people were coming to see me, students who come to see me, I'm obviously going to have a different approach than the classroom teacher. And usually the students are going to be liking that fact because the approach I use is more user-friendly to their learning style. So it would be great if we could get the school to be more like that. But I hope that answered the question.
Yeah.
As long as you get something in there that's effective.
Mm-hmm. I imagine you do a number of assessments when you first meet a child to determine what their strengths and weaknesses are. Would that be correct?
Yes. So mostly I use what's called diagnostic prescriptive teaching to supplement any testing that I might get from a psychologist or a neuropsychologist. That doesn't always happen, but usually it does. Because usually by the time you figure out that tutoring isn't working, the school isn't working, and you're ready to make that leap to somebody who's one-on-one and highly trained, you've probably gathered a lot more information by then. So what diagnostic prescriptive teaching is as I watch a child, because I've seen so many hundreds of people, as I watch a child perform any task, reading, let's say, the amount of time it takes them between words, the everything, where their eyes are, when I ask a question, how long before I get an answer, all of these, because I have the instincts and hundreds of people that I've seen do this, that tells me something about you. And as soon as I notice that, I know what I need to do to help you. That's what diagnostic prescriptive teaching is. It's that ability to use all those clinical instincts and information that you've gathered over all the decades as a person does a task to realize what probably is going on in their mind at that time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Gertrude from New York City asks, when teaching an autistic child to read, would you recommend introducing the child to books that have been published for kids on the spectrum, or start them out with traditional reading materials such as regular books?
Oh, okay. So every learner has to go through the same set of steps, which is to become a good reader, that is, which is acquiring those sound symbol associations. Most people call that phonics, and that's okay to call it that. And then also developing a set of sight words, words that they don't have to sound out, particularly since you can't sound them out, like wound and wound. That's a good example. You don't know which one that is. And then building to larger units, like being able to recognize syllables. These are all progressions that everyone has to go through. And depending on your child's profile, if your child is having difficulty with auditory processing, what I would start with as a parent is making sure that you're beginning to address that auditory processing problem as soon as possible, because it's only going to hold back that key aspect of developing the phonetic-based reading, which every brain has to do. Everyone's brain has to have a phonetic reading system well-developed in order to become a good reader. But they also simultaneously, as they're becoming good readers, need to have a visual reading system develop. That's to recognize the words by sight easily, where you don't have to sound them out. So I'm assuming that we're talking about a six-year-old child or some very close to that, 5-6-year-old child. I would start with books that are enjoyable to your child, because you want to make sure that you're reading to your child and your child is understanding what you're doing and you're understanding that these little pieces of squiggles actually convey some meaning. Make sure you've got that down pat before you move on from there. And then you've got to be addressing both the visual and the auditory-based reading systems. So it doesn't matter whether you pick one particular type of book at first, but the most important thing is that it's successful, that it's a pleasant, successful experience. So with your skills as a parent teacher, with your child's profile of strengths and weaknesses, and with their age and expectations and interests, factor all that in and stick with things that your child understands. You are actually getting meaning from those little squiggles, and that it's enjoyable meaning to your child.
Should you, just off the top of my head, should you, when you're building upon reading successes, should you continue to have them reading the books they've already mastered, as well as introducing a challenging book?
Yeah, that's good. It depends on the reasons that they're continuing to read the ones that they've already mastered. If it's because they have an insecurity about moving on, is a different thing than that they need a lot of practice in order to really, really master it. They're different reasons. Mm-hmm. So if you really, really need a lot of practice at something, then, and by the way, they're actually related, the more comfortable one feels in any skill that they've already acquired, the more the easier it is to go into that next challenging thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so our own current, for all of us, our own current skill base is our warm blanket that helps us take that next risky leap.
Yeah.
So helping to connect with your own skill set can only help you to move forward. But then again, it might reach a point where your child is reading it over and over and over and not wishing to let go of it. And if that becomes something of an issue, then I would suggest trying to figure out what it is about that book that is so enticing, and trying to find something else that's just so enticing in that same way, and trying to expand their horizon on enticing things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Cheryl from Redford asks, does reading comprehension improvements help with their verbal communication skills? Do you find that to be the case?
Yes, it's a feedback loop. Any improvement in verbal skills will, without being, it needs to be taught naturally, but it will ultimately translate into improvements in reading comprehension given the right support and structure. And improvements in reading comprehension will, with the right support and structure, again, don't expect transfer without building it in, will improve reading verbal ability. And that's one of the things that I was mentioning when I talked about paraphrasing and summarizing and how crucial a skill that is, because it does improve your thinking abilities to be able to do that, and that in turn improves your reading comprehension.
So for a child like mine that doesn't have strong verbal skills, how do I know he...
How do I know he can read? You're asking a really excellent question. And here again, I don't know your child, but there's a difference between what he can speak and what his language is internally.
Mm-hmm.
And what you really want to make sure that he has the ability to develop is that internal verbal ability, whether or not he can speak it to you. Did that make sense?
Yeah. I'm just wondering how I test that.
So how do you find that?
Yeah.
The first thing you would use is a recognition task. Now, that recognition could be, I don't happen to have this system, but for kids who have a tremendous difficulty making their thoughts and their needs known, there is a pictorial system, and in fact, I think there are some apps for that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so being using that kind of a system, making sure it's in there first. So you might be able to come up with a series of pictures, not necessarily a series as in step one, step two, step two, step three, but some pictures that he could choose among to show what's going on.
Ah, okay.
Obviously he can't read, but again, you could read, if you wanted to write down something, you know, option one, option two, read it to him and see which one he chose. That might also work, depending on his level of ability to hold on. That would be working memory. So now working memory is the ability to hold on to what somebody just said while I think about it and then decide which one of those two.
Mm-hmm.
And working memory is not verbalization or that verbal language ability. It's something different. It's a memory skill. But it can get in our way of thinking that kids have language issues when what they have is a memory issue. You have to take as many things out of the picture as possible to really know.
Yeah. It's been such a long time since I learned how to read that I don't remember what steps I did it in.
Yeah, and well, you wouldn't have known anyway because that takes the ability of the frontal lobes to be able to take a top-down view of what's going on at any point in time, and you weren't young enough. I mean, you were too young.
Yeah. So in order to teach my child how to read, I need to understand those steps, and so that's what your packet is supposed to help us do, right?
Well, it certainly will help you with one piece, that getting ready to read. That's those steps in and of themselves would be a giant help for a lot of people on the call.
Sure, sure. Okay. Patty from Rayford asks, how do you get your child to enjoy reading books that don't have a lot of pictures?
Mm-hmm.
She says, I have a fourth grader who doesn't mind reading books with pictures, but the moment we try to get him to read a chapter book, more on his level, he throws a fit.
Yeah, that's a tough one, isn't it? Well, I have solutions, but of course they always involve parental effort. And so, you know, what I would do is I would realize that you can't make a leap, and that's what the child's being asked to do. We can make small steps. So there's a couple of strategies I could suggest. If that, I would make sure that that chapter book is something that is compelling to your child's interests, or else why would your child take all these leaps away from comfort zone if it's not something that's enticing? Then I would also do something else. I would probably take turns reading, and I would probably do something like acting it out or drawing pictures. I would also probably draw a couple of pictures myself at the beginning of the book to get them interested. I mean, anything that makes a transition from where you are to where you want to be in easy steps. So if we go from a big, colorful, exciting picture on each and every page to a book that has none, is there anybody that's going to vote for that? No. You have to do it step by step. You have to find a way to give the reader what they're eager for. If they want more pictures, put in some more pictures. Read some of it themselves, some of it yourself. Act it out. Then there's also, depending on your child's age, do we have an age there?
No.
Okay. Well, I assume it's probably in the second, third grade kind of thing. So you're still at the age where your own long-term goals don't figure into it. So I would still think about some kind of reward system. It wouldn't be the only thing I'd use by a long shot, but I would still put in, when you get your first chapter book read, and I'm going to help you read it, I'm going to make a couple of pictures for you, I'm going to read every other page, whatever it is that you need to do to transition, then you'll get this neat reward. And again, you've got to make sure it's a book they really want to read.
Yeah. Here's a question. It says, my third grader is high-functioning autism, and this year he seems to be struggling more with reading comprehension than last year. He just doesn't seem to be ready for third grade. Have you ever suggested retaining a child to help with reading comprehension skills and to build confidence?
Oh, that's such a great question. You know, there's enough research on the general population of kids who have learning difficulties and retention, but I am not aware of any studies on kids with autism and retention. So I can answer from the standpoint of what research has shown us for kids with learning issues in general, and that would probably primarily be kids with learning disabilities. It's shown that kids do not catch up and that they forever afterwards carry a burden of, I'm stupid, I got left behind. Mm-hmm. And so I got to say, retention is not my first choice. Sometimes it's a perfect choice for a particular individual, and I want to make sure I make that clear. If your child is not going to be burdened with this, oh, they left me behind mentality, and if your child is going to be in an environment that's going to actually teach the skills that are difficult to learn, because believe me, it's not just a matter of maturation. It's not just, oh, give them another year and everything will come online. It's a matter of, this is a skill that's not going to come online without direct instruction. So if retaining provides an opportunity for direct instruction and also doesn't have the burden of, I'm a failure, then it could be a good call for your child. But if it doesn't have those two elements, it's not going to be a good call. In fact, it's probably going to be a bad call because your child's now got another burden. Now they, not only do they have the reading comprehension issues they always had and they were not addressed, but now they feel like they're a real failure.
Uh-huh. I've heard a lot of people mention that their child had hyperlexia.
Oh, that's exactly what we're talking about here, yes.
Okay. All right. I've had people tell me, too, that their child could write before he could read.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of that?
Well, it depends on how we define write and read, right? My definition of read is gaining meaning from little squiggles.
Mm-hmm.
Writing, on the other hand, is communicating meaning with little squiggles. using those definitions, it's impossible to write before you can read.
True.
Yeah.
Unless you didn't know what you were writing.
You can copy, but conveying meaning, you see, that would involve you understanding the system of what those squiggles mean.
Exactly.
So, like I say, I think it's a definitional issue there.
I agree. Laura from North Carolina asks, what are some examples of auditory processing drills for a 10-year-old?
Great. Okay. I wish I had a source that I could send you to, because the one I use it's not something that a person can buy. I'm a provider for this company. That's how I have this mechanism. But what you need is you need words that vary the sounds that are difficult for your child. Some of the sounds that are typically difficult are the, I'll spell them because if you can't really understand what I'm saying when I use the sounds, the V, like victory, the TH, like them, and this, them, and this. Oh, they're the same. I need one where it's soft. Think. TH is two sounds. The one we call voiced, them, and the one we call voiceless, this. So V, T, H, and F, as in Frank. Those four sounds are profoundly difficult to hear. Let's see what else. You could have it really in any sounds, but also the short E, eh, like Edward, and the short I, like igloo, eh, are very challenging to hear the difference for a lot of folks. Some kids have auditory processing problems that go beyond that, but at least those sounds there are ones that you should be on the alert for. Some people have difficulty with the M, like mother, and the N, like Nancy. What you want to do, you don't want to directly just start going, okay, I'm going to say very and very, and you tell me which one I said, because that's way too up in the hierarchy. What you want to do is you want to start with, as the principles of this whole talk was, start with the interests and the current ability levels and the strengths. So anything that your child can hear the difference in is a strength. Anything that your child can see the difference in is a strength. So what you do when you're having difficulty hearing the difference in sounds, but you can see the difference in the letters, is you present those two together, written down, and have you point to one. Let's say it's the V. Point to the V like victory. Point to the V and say, I'm going to say this sound for you. I'd like you to watch my mouth. And I want you to watch where I put my tongue and my teeth and my lips. You really make it really clear where all parts of the mouth are. You have to get down to that level so they can see it. And then you're going to do the same for the TH, the voiced TH, Z. And you, V and Z sound very much alike, don't they? But they are not produced the same way in the mouth. So do that in front of the mirror a couple of times until you can see the difference. Where are my lips? Where is my tongue? Where is my top teeth? What am I doing with those? And then just describe that to your child and have your child look at you as you say some words and tell you whether it's the V or the V or the TH. That's the first step. You start by making it a visual task. And you build that in as long as it takes until you're able to then take the visual out of it and tell them, your child, I'm going to give you one of them. You tell me which one it is. And you try it out and you see how well it goes. If it's like hardly any of them right, you know that it's too soon and you need to do more visual. You can also help your child to feel, use their motor sense to feel the difference in the sounds, by actually touching their lips, face, throat as they're making those sounds. And you can also give your child different kind of feedback by having your child make those sounds and look in a mirror so that you get, yet again, a different type of visual feedback.
It seems to be crossing over a little bit into speech therapy.
Absolutely. Okay. Yes, speech therapists do auditory processing training. Absolutely.
Okay. Michelle from Frederick asks, if a child has difficulty with the physical task of writing, how do you suggest teaching or adapting the visual note-taking part?
Okay. Yes, a lot of our kids do have handwriting issues. First of all, I want to make sure that anything that an occupational therapist could do to help that has been put in place, because sometimes an occupational therapist can make a great benefit in a child's ability to withstand the motor aspects of writing. Depending on the age of the child, the amount of writing that needs to be done, trying to get a general answer here. Obviously, the higher up in the grade levels, the more writing is expected. And so having the note-taking system would be to their advantage. The younger kids, of course, we can do a lot of workarounds. We can fill it in for them to get them started. Oh, that's always a good strategy. If your child is fatiguing for any reason because of any type of disability, take turns on it. Even getting them a buddy that's not you is helpful. The visual note-taking system, some kids, now I always advocate having that if possible, but some kids can do with a more limited version because their auditory skills, their auditory memory, their auditory working memory are very strong. So it depends on the person. But sometimes talking it out provides the kind of feedback, because think about it, when you talk, your mouth moves. That's movement. So a part of your brain that controls movement is active. When you talk and say words, the parts of your brain that process language are active. And when you gesture, a different part of your brain comes on to control that. When you talk and you listen, a different part of your brain processes what's being heard. So my mantra is, the more parts of the brain I can get turned on in any learning activity, the more confident I am that learning is occurring. So if your child can point, if your child can talk and listen, if your child can record and then play it back, if you can take turns with your child writing it, if you can have a pre-drawn graphic or outline where the writing is less intensive, if you can, if you've gone to the occupational therapist and gotten all the help you can, if you're using a writing grip, by the way, that might help. Now, I know some kids, they resist change, they resist using the writing grip, I understand, but the writing grip sometimes can loosen things up. Oh, there's also, there might be on my website, I don't remember, I will post something, so in my blog, I will post something in my blog that are some strategies that I got from an occupational therapist for how to help strengthen and relax the hands. So if you don't have those activities, I will make a point to put that in my blog.
That's very nice. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Virginia from Florida asks, for kids who have a high level of reading ability very young, preschool age, what can we focus on to help them retain their reading ability and also to develop skills as they move forward so they don't become frustrated or discouraged?
Okay, so that can often be a pattern that, and I think you're probably referring to sounding out as opposed to comprehension when you use the term reading, because reading comprehension for a preschooler at the level that we're talking about, for example, a high school student, is not the same task. And so I assume you're talking about sounding out the words. And in that case, this is a common pattern. It is called hyperlexia. Kids seem to have an advanced ability to sound out the words, to quote-unquote read the words there, but their ability to truly conceptualize what those words are conveying may not, if it's hyperlexia, does not equal their ability to sound them out. And so when kids are sounding out words, you need to be really cautious that you're not attributing to them comprehension that they don't possess. Make sure that you're asking good questions like, who did that? And at preschool, it's a who did that? Why did they do that? What did they do? It's your very basic 5W kinds of questions. And if kids are having difficulty with any of those, you might see a pattern. You might see a pattern they don't have much of an idea of the whys and the hows, but they do have a good idea of the who and the what and the when. So the more concrete things may stick with them, but the more inferential, abstract things may not. When you put all of this together, you'll have more of an idea of what you need to teach. Now, you do want to keep the word attack skills moving forward, because at kindergarten, it's just beginning, or preschool, it's just even at kindergarten, even at fourth grade, you're just beginning to develop those skills. At fourth grade, you're almost at what we call the structural analysis phase of reading recognition, which is where you've got some sight words, you know most of your phonics elements, but now you're beginning to see bigger units like prefixes and suffixes, and you're beginning to understand how prefixes and suffixes change the meanings of words. You're able to see these more complicated phonetic elements. So you're still a long way from a skilled word sounder outer at that phase. And if your comprehension is not developing at the same time, you're still a long way, even in fourth grade, you're still a long way from being able to do the kind of inferences that we need to do, let's say on the SAT or something like that. You're way far from that. So you want to make sure you're running these two word recognition and comprehension strands simultaneously, and you're continually moving each one along. And it's okay to move one along so that maybe your word recognition's on a second grade level, but your comprehension of the what, when, and who is on a second grade level, but your whys and hows are more on a kindergarten or first grade level. That's okay to see that discrepancy as long as you're working at the right level for each of those tasks. And the right level is the level where the child is now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This is more of a statement than a question, but it reminds me that my husband was actually taught whole words, sight mm-hmm. words, mm-hmm. as opposed to sounding out words. And Kim says, so he has a terrible time sounding out words and spelling and everything now.
Yeah.
But Kim from Jacksonville says it can be frustrating for her son to successfully sound out words, especially when the words have silent letters or are exceptions to the rules. She says her son has to memorize words more than try to figure out the rules.
Okay, so, so there are, unfortunately, our most common English words, many of them are not very phonetic, and we just have to memorize those. But there are a significant number of words that we read, and they're not the ones we usually talk a lot. You know, we talk the words we use a lot, like come and stuff like that, those are not very phonetic, and we just have to memorize those. But there are a lot of words that are perfectly phonetic, so all of the phonetics elements need to be taught individually. Any ones that your child already has, great. The ones that he doesn't have need to be explicitly taught. But at the same time, you need to have that bank of sight words, because some of them can't be sounded out. And what I always recommend when I'm working with kids and I'm teaching them sight words, I always use a multisensory approach. Depending on the age of the child, I find something that I think is going to be fun for them, because this is going to be a very repetitive task. A lot of kids like to use color. Okay, so color, I always put color into it. So I let them choose from my 5 or 6 really bright colors of pieces of paper the color they want to have. And I always go, ooh, what a great choice, right? I always try to make it as fun as possible and put a lot of personality into it, because it's going to be a deadly dull drill. And then I get out my, I think there's about 8 of them, my 8 little either markers or my fine point colored things, I don't know what they're called, gel pens or something. Oh, and that's another great thing. Get some black paper and some gel pens. Make it as fun as possible. So it depends on the age of the child, of course. So if your child likes whiteboards, I'll give you 5 or 6 different ways. Okay, so you can get in front of a whiteboard, and you can stand on a balance beam, one of those balance boards. I don't know if you all have seen those. They're like little rocker boards. What's great about the rocker board is when you're balancing, it turns on the reticular activating system. That's the part of the brain in the brainstem that also controls attention. So for kids who have ADHD, we do a lot of stuff on the balance board, because it helps them there's another good one for the lady with the focus question. Get a balance board. And stand on that balance board, and as you're balancing, or if you're sitting at the desk with your colored markers, however you're doing this, let's say we're going to learn the word come. So we're going to write the letter C. We're going to look at the letter C, and we're going to say the letter C at the same time. So we're going to write each letter and spell it as we write. And then when we get to the end, we're going to say the entire word. So it's going to sound like this, C-O-M-E, come. What we're doing is we're hyper-focusing down in on each letter, and then we're zoom tool out, and we're saying the entire word. And we're using our eyes, our ears, our body at the same time. We're getting as much of our brain turned on as possible. And if we're making it fun, we're also getting more of that part of the brain turned on, whatever part is processing that. And that for one, is the limbic system, which is in charge of our emotions and our memory, by the way. And if we get color, then we get the part of the visual system that's processing color. We could put it on a piece of paper. If your child likes dinosaurs, then run off a lot of great pieces of paper that have dinosaurs on them and have your child practice the word on the dinosaur paper. Anything that makes this dull task more enjoyable, because your child is going to do the C-O-M-E, come, for a long time. I suggest 10 to 20 times at the first go-round and seeing if it sticks. If it doesn't stick, then come back and do it again. So obviously you do one of those a day. There's no way you can do more than that because it's kind of deadly dull. But you want to make it as much fun as possible, because that repetition and turning on as many centers as the brain as possible is the key to learning a word quick. Did I drift from the question?
No.
Okay.
No, actually, I was going to tack on to that I have a couple of friends who run over spelling words with their child while they're bouncing on the trampoline.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, exactly. I do that too.
So there you go. I don't know if the parent's bouncing or if the child's bouncing, but somebody's bouncing.
Oh, and so I said I'd give you some more.
Yes.
Toss a ball back and forth. So I have this little beanbag kind of thing, ball. So I toss it, say C, you toss it back, say O. I toss it, say M, you toss it, say E. I say come. Then you say C, I say O. That way we'll alternate roles so that the child is always changing from C, M, come to O, E, C, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Did you have more?
I like the trampoline. Yes, multisensory can be done in a lot of different ways. If you have a sand, I don't happen to have one because I can't find the right container. But if you have a very short, like maybe inch and a half tall, and very wide, maybe 16 inches, kind of like a, you could do this easily at your house because you don't need a lid. So get a baking tray. And put anything you like rice or sand or small little things, okay? And your child writes in that medium rather than using a pen.
Nice.
And that turns on the receptors in the fingers, too.
I like it.
You know what I used to do with my kids? You don't get as much visual input, but every now and then as a reward when they had reached a milestone. What their reward was is we made up some Jell-O, and we didn't let it solidify. We made it up. We put it in that baking tray. We let them choose their favorite flavor, and then they would write their words in the Jell-O. So you know what they're going to do, right? They're going to write the word and then lick their finger.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
That's a good reward.
I'm running out of paper. I did have one more question. How are reading and math related, besides the obvious word problems?
Ah, good question. Well, yes, word problems are a significant reading comprehension challenge, but as I mentioned, don't leave it for granted that skills are going to transfer from one to another. This is a perfect example, because the type of thinking done in mathematics, and therefore the type of thinking that you're comprehending when you read, is very different than the type of thinking that's done in the other subjects. So for reading comprehension in a word problem, I'm going to address with that first, you need to teach the type of thinking processes that are going on in the word problem. You have to teach it explicitly. So one of the things we're doing in a word problem is for older kids is a clone model. I call it a clone model. And that's multiplication and division. So like Sally went to the store. Oh, that's a bad example. Okay, well, Sally bought a pizza every night for 5 nights. How many pizzas did Sally buy? Well, see, there's your clone. Your clone is buy a pizza, buy a pizza, buy a pizza. They're all identical copies of each other. So teaching kids that model of identical copies, I call it clones, allows them to look at the reading comprehension and identify that's a clone model. So in other words, there's these basic models that we use in mathematics. All of those, the structure of the passage, all of those have to be taught. How else is our reading and math alike? Just very globally, that you know, the squiggles have meaning, mm-hmm. and everybody needs to know that. And that and math is a little different, though, in the attention to detail can be even harder because plus and minus can look so much like. But then there is that transfer factor of different typefaces. Sometimes kids can't identify A written in Times Roman if they're used to it in Arial or whatever. So they're very global kinds of similarities.
Mm-hmm. They lost me in math class when they started putting letters in the math problems because it's not math, it's reading.
See, that was the flaw in the education you had, not making real good instruction to show you what was really going on there. That's too bad.
Yeah, I'm much... liked geometry a lot better than algebra. As is the case often, we run out of time, and once again, we are at that point where we're out of time. But I'm going to be sure that all these questions are emailed to you after we're finished here, so anything we didn't get to or anything that didn't get addressed, you can address one-on-one if you choose.
Okay.
And folks can also send you their questions through your website. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. If you would go to the contact page on the website, it's pretty easy to find, then you can do it that way.
Okay. And your website one more time.
MillerEducationalExcellence.com.
Okay. And if they add that / Moms Fighting Autism, they can get the extra goodies that you've provided, right?
They'll be able to get the slideshow as a PDF and the handout packet of the templates. Give me a couple of days to put up the hand strengthening and relaxation exercises into my blog.
Wonderful. I already did all my spiel about if you want a transcript, join the Spectrum Gold Club, so I won't bore you all with that again. But I do want to remind you to mark your calendars now to join us on October 17th. As we welcome Valerie Herskowitz, who will be talking about speech and language issues. Thank you so much, Dr. Miller, for joining us this evening and for such a wonderful presentation.
Oh, thanks. It was a real privilege.
And I hope you'll come back and join us sometime.
Oh, excellent. Thank you.
And thank you, everyone else, for being such an active participant and sending in your questions. It really helps keep us on task and keep us going. So thank you for participating, and I hope everyone has a great night.